This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. As we're getting close to the end of 2017, some end-of-the-year financial tips from Greg. Also, a conversation with Lake Central School Superintendent Larry Baracco. There's going to be a community conversation at Lake Central High School this evening, starting at 6 o'clock, about the state of funding for the district and the possibility of a referendum in 2018. We'll find out more about that coming up, as well as conversation from Lakeshore Focus from Lakeshore PPS. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, as we get near the end of 2017, it's time to plan for 2018 and to do so the right way. We thought we'd call in Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer to offer some tips here as well. Greg, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, first, let's start off here, I guess, and some of the things that we should do this, I guess, all year long and any year for that matter, too, is to invest in oneself. Tell us about that.
Well, I think at the end of the year is just an excellent time to begin to look at where your contributions are, especially with your retirement accounts, because that's often the time that you can have an open enrollment, change contribution levels. And it's also a time where you have a pretty accurate idea, you know, where your income is going to land for the year, whether you're eligible for additional contributions to possibly a Roth IRA or a spousal IRA, or you know, whether or not conversions might make sense, because you have more accurate data than you would, say, in January of, you know, of that year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talk about spousal contributions. How's that likely to be possible?
So everybody is eligible to do a spousal contributions based on whether or not they have a group plan that they're eligible to contribute to, and then income levels. So whether or not you have a deductible contribution is based on some parameters. Everybody can make a contribution to an IRA, but the key is whether or not it is actually deductible, and then whether you should look at a traditional versus a Roth, because the limits are different. And oftentimes it's difficult to determine, you know, where you're going to land for total income until you get into December.
Now, you talk about those two types of individual retirement accounts. For folks that are not familiar with this, tell us about the difference between the traditional IRA and a Roth IRA.
Sure. So basically, the government allows generally three types of tax treatments. One, you can have a deduction. Two, you can have deferred growth. So while it's growing in that account, there's no 1099s or nothing that lands on your tax return. And then third, the distribution could be tax-free. Mm-hmm. What they don't allow is for to have all three of those. So the traditional IRA is about, you know, what your tax benefits would be in terms of taking off the return in today's income level and getting the deduction today and having the deferred growth, where the Roth IRA would be more about how we can mitigate the tax liability in the future. So we don't take the deduction today, but we have deferred growth, but then distributions don't impact the tax return. We don't have to pay taxes on them.
That's the advantage of switching over from one to the Roth?
Yeah, and again, it doesn't always make sense to go all the way to the Roth. For example, a lot of folks, their higher tax bracket, you know, may be while they're working, and the way they're going to structure their income in retirement, they may never be in a higher tax bracket. So, you know, their benefit might be taking the deduction today. And that's just part of what you want to look at and consider, you know, just in your overall retirement planning, you know, what are your objectives? What type of income are you going to look to have in retirement? And the things that you're doing, is it realistic? And then decide, you know, where is it better to mitigate taxes, today or in the future? Okay. Generally, I tell people it's a little bit of both, because we don't know where the government's going to land year to year with, you know, even what tax brackets are going to be.
I see. Okay. Well, we talk here about investing in oneself here. Another way we should look into taking a look into the new year is to reducing your tax bill. And such a good time to talk about that now, because we only have just a matter of days before the end of the month. And in particular, the opportunity to claim charitable deductions. That's obviously one way that you can reduce your tax bill if you can get that in there, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of people will do regular tithing and gift giving throughout the year. But again, at the end of the year, if it's a situation where you have some monies that you might want to earmark towards a charity, it would always be beneficial, especially if you're itemizing in a year where you might not be itemizing the following year, to consider giving that particular organization that you favor some type of charitable giving, which would allow you to reduce your tax bill.
Now, obviously, you have to be sure, if you haven't thought about this before, that you have to be sure that you have enough, I suppose, in your charitable giving list to be able to earn that that deduction. Because I know that the Internal Revenue Service won't let you just put every little dollar in. You've got to have a big chunk, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. So what it means basically is, as most people progress towards retirement, the normal things that they have the list as itemized deductions are reduced or often even go away. For example, a lot of people don't carry mortgage interest into retirement. Mm-hmm. So when you start it, or they're not earning as much as when they were younger, so they don't have the state taxes on there for deductions. So if you don't pass your standard deduction, you can't itemize the charitable contributions. So it becomes a little bit more difficult. Standard deduction is over $12,000. So for a lot of folks, they don't even have that much with itemized deductions. So even though they're giving money to a charitable organization, it may not impact taxes at all for them.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. End of the year financial tips and continuing on a little list here. Another thing that we should look into, if we haven't already, is to rebalance your assets.
Yeah, and I think this is probably one of the things that are most easy to overlook in the planning process, because when you first create a plan and you evaluate your risk tolerance and you create an allocation, there's going to be a tendency for that allocation to get warped. What I mean by that, Chris, is you look at the last 9 years, market's done really well. So if I was 50% in a balanced allocation, let's say bonds and equities, the equities have well outperformed bonds over the last 9 years. So by the sheer growth of that equity side of the portion, you're no longer a 50-50 balance. So that's where you want to make sure that you're bringing back your balance to where you want it to be, so there's not a shock value when the market does correct, and all of a sudden you're 70-30 when you were in your mind the entire time being 50-50. And that's why a lot of people will use models, because it will automatically rebalance. And then also you just want to make sure that your risk tolerance is still the same from 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago. Generally, as things change over individuals and families' lifetime, a lot of times their priorities change and then their risk tolerance will change as well. So it's always good to evaluate, in my opinion, at least annually, you know, where your allocations are, reassess your risk tolerance, and make sure that the plan is what you understand to be.
Yeah, I guess the closer you get to retirement and you really don't want to take much more risk with your investments, maybe you're not necessarily going to be chancing it more, I suppose, with the stock market. If the stock market is, if you've got your things in certain stocks that maybe have tend to gone up and down a lot, or even, taken a big dump for that matter, too, I suppose you're going to say, well, maybe I ought to get out of these and go into something that's a little more stable.
Yeah, and I think part of it, too, is just the actual shift in what the purpose of the money is. While we're working, it's all about accumulating. So it's all about return. It's all about not needing the money. You're not taking distributions. And it's all about long-term objectives. As you near that retirement, when you retire, you don't have the luxury of saying, oh, let's not take money out if the market goes down, which is, always the first rule, right? Never take money out when the market's down. But what you become subject to is what we call sequence of return risk. That order, if it's not favorable when the returns occur as you move into retirement, could be very detrimental to that particular portfolio when you enter that distribution phase of life.
Now, besides taking a look at your portfolio, you probably should also take a look at your estate plans, too. You're not necessarily thinking for that day. That will happen someday in the future, but you've still got to be prepared for it, though.
Oh, absolutely. This is probably one of the biggest areas that we sit down with folks that they don't even realize that their beneficiaries were either named improperly or not named at all. And it's rare, but there's a lot of group plans that, you may have submitted the paperwork, maybe it never got recorded properly. Maybe there was a changeover internally with group plans, and the actual beneficiaries didn't come over, or your beneficiaries have changed, especially younger couples. You know, they get married, and for years everything was mom and dad, and you know, never really thought about or never got around to switching it to the spouse. Or you know, you have children, and the priorities of who you want to have those benefits go to, or you have a loss of a loved one. You know, and those things are not the priority to visit at the time of those life-changing events, and they often get pushed by the wayside. And what that does is create a lot of challenges to settle the estate for the people that are receiving the benefits, and sometimes it could have cost implications that could have been avoided with just simply making sure that the beneficiary designations were labeled as you want them to, and then also in addition to that, making sure even the non-qualified ones are all transferable on death. Mm-hmm.
And we talk here about estate plans and making sure that you've got the latest information in, so that's prepared for what may happen in the future. But I guess you've got your insurance policies as well, too. You got to take a look at those, too, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, especially property and casualty, some of your liability coverages, like your homeowners, it's always good to reassess that. I don't know if it's necessarily annually, but again, with those particular programs, often we're driven by price. And when we talk to individuals, you know, the price, sometimes it doesn't make sense always to be the least expensive, you know, if it's going to be detrimental to everything you've accumulated over your lifetime. If you don't have the type of coverages you need, and then, you know, something happens and they could, you know, change, you know, the perspective of your life, or of your financial plan by those assets being subject or liable to creditors or any type of suit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the insurance aspect of it, and, you know, things are constantly changing with group plans where a lot of people carry their health insurance, a lot of people carry their life insurance, and it's always good to evaluate that enrollment period and make sure that the plan you're electing is what you understand it to be.
Now, certainly nowadays when we have all the changes, everything is in flux as far as health care coverage is concerned with the Affordable Care Act and some of the other independent private policies out there, too. You want to be sure that you're all lined up properly.
Absolutely. You're spot on with that, Chris, because the health is probably the biggest area of change over the last couple of years, because the plans that were there 3, 4, 5 years ago probably aren't even options anymore. So somebody signed up for a health plan, or the last time they used it, they were very happy, very pleased, don't want to change it. But what they don't realize is the plans have changed. And you don't want to find out about that when you need it. When you need it is not the time to evaluate the coverage you have.
Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer with us to talk about some end-of-the-year planning they should do financially. And as always, Greg, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it. And a happy new year to you, and we'll talk with you for sure in 2018.
Thanks, Chris. Have a great holiday.
Thank you. Hoosier community groups and businesses have a message for Indiana's congressional delegation. Find a solution for DACA. The program allows minors who came into the country illegally to get an education and receive work permits. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman tells us about a recent roundtable discussion.
The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Act, or DACA, expires March 6th, and the Trump administration has tasked Congress with finding a permanent replacement. There are several pending bills, including the DREAM Act, which would provide a path to citizenship for DACA recipients. Kathy Downey with Democratic U.S. Representative Andre Carson's office says this isn't a partisan issue. All of the pending bills have bipartisan support.
It is going to take Republicans to engage in this conversation, beyond the conversation, to bring a vote to the floor on DREAM Act. We can't do it by ourselves.
Republican Representative Susan Brooks supports another pending bill, the Recognizing America's Children Act, which also provides a pathway to citizenship. Carson is one of 200 co-sponsors of the DREAM Act. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Tonight is going to be a community conversation held in the auditorium at Lake Central High School in St. John about the state of funding for the Lake Central School District. And we have with us Superintendent Larry Verocco to talk about the discussion and the reasoning behind it. Larry, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, first give us some basic details here, the who, what, where, when, why, and all that concerning this discussion this evening at the Lake Central High School auditorium.
Sure. Well, first, let me give the details on where and when, and you know, we do want our community to come out. It is this evening, beginning at 6 o'clock in the auditorium or theater, however you want to describe it. Residents, guests should enter doors A or B. we anticipate the program to take about 45 minutes, and then there's a second piece of this where we want to hear concerns and questions from folks. That should take another half hour to 45 minutes. So we expect it to be about a 90-minute commitment mm-hmm. from our guests.
Let me expand and say,
you know, the purpose is we just think it's time to share with our community sort of how the game has changed over the last decade, where we came from an era where property tax covered about 75% of our operating fund to now it's none of our operating fund. The state provides all of the tuition support through their revenues. And, you know, there have been some things that have really worked against us as our community has gotten wealthier. The funding formula tends to work in an inverse fashion to the wealth of your community. So we're at the bottom of how much we receive per child. There have been some dilutive effects that everyone who's following this story knows that money's been carved out for charter schools and private schools through the voucher programs. And then really we'll share with our community that the TIF districts have had an impact on us as well.
Mm-hmm. We've mentioned this before in the past. In fact, we know even just within even this year alone that the successes of similar referenda in Hobart as well as in the city of Hammond have kind of given thought to, I'm sure, to a lot of school districts. And even before in a discussion I know that we had with Larry DeBoer of Purdue University, that a lot of the times superintendents get together, you talk, and you have a chance to meet on a more formal basis occasionally. So you know the topic has come up before, and this more school districts across Northwest Indiana, as well as around the state of Indiana, are turning to referendum to be able to try to ask their residents and patrons to decide whether you need more support for the school systems. And you mentioned, too, about the fact that you have different schools that are now in the mix now than what had been in the recent years when you talk about the charter schools and other similar private schools, too.
Right. And, you know, the state has made a commitment to divide up the pie in more ways. And as we've had ongoing conversations with our locally elected officials, statewide officials, you know, they've indicated to us on more than one occasion, you know, there are the opportunities to generate more revenue to do those special things that you want to do. And for us, some of them aren't that special. Some of them are to control class size and to keep people from plucking our, you know, younger, bright teachers. But the two options are to open your boundaries, which I think would be incredibly unpopular for our community. And then, of course, to go back and ask the taxpayer for more help so that we can, you know, keep those things that are on our radar, things that are important to us, things that we believe make us who we are. You know, over time, we do need more money to accomplish those tasks.
Mm-hmm. As a point of reference, I think the last superintendent, not superintendent, but the last referenda that had been brought up there at the Lake Central Schools was, what, about 2011, as I recall? And that was, of course, about the time that you were trying to get the work done on not only Lake Central High School, but to replace an elementary school and some other construction projects. A little different than what you're asking for the possibility this time, right?
It is very different. And, you know, for some people, it's easier to support, you know, the brick and mortar that you know is going to last 50 years and you got to pay for it for 20, but then it's done, versus some people are saying, you know, I've more fully support the idea of what's going on in the classroom. So, you know, it's a different story, but the bottom line is, you know, we have kept track of where we are compared to other folks, and a lot of districts like us and some not like us have gone back to their taxpayers for support, and they've been successful, and more have been successful over time.
Mm-hmm.
I think in large part because it just appears that the state is comfortable allowing you to present an average academic experience for students, and we just believe it's our job to, you know, provide an outstanding academic experience so that our kids are ready for adulthood.
And I imagine, too, that we get all this push from the State House about wanting to improve workforce training and other types of planning like that, too, that kind of makes it more incumbent upon you as a public school superintendent to be sure that that your high school students, if they're not going into the trades or something like that, or they're not, especially if they're not going to college, if they're looking at some kind of a training afterward, that they have the right, I guess, basics to go into that vocational school or trade school or whatever the case may be, or even apprenticeship, I suppose.
I think you've been reading a little bit about the graduation pathways enough to know that there are going to be some unfunded mandates as part of that package. And so we do need to be preparing for that, because the objective is to have some things for those non-college-bound kids more than what we do currently. And, of course, there will be a price tag attached to that. So that would be the programming side, which, you know, is something we have on our radar screen as well. So you're correct about that.
I would imagine, too, because you have entities like Ivy Tech Community College out there, although they are pushing to see that the students that are enrolled at Ivy Tech not only get involved in going on and maybe get finishing up their college education if they might start out for their first 2 years with Ivy Tech, but they, too, may also go back to the traditional model of looking for some educational help that will get them into a trade or get them into some specialization that they can follow through as a career in the for them as well. So I can see why you have to take a look and see, are our high school graduates getting everything that they need if they are not going to go on to college someplace?
Yeah, and I think it's important for people who are judging what the end product is, what the opportunities are. And so when I was down at Indianapolis last week to consider that pathway, there are many small districts who can't offer the types of opportunities you're able to offer when you have many school districts in one area. And while we have three in-house vocational programs, we also participate in the Hammond Area Career Center, which offers another 8 or 9 opportunities for students. And so, yeah, I think that that's something we just hope that all of our people focus on, that you need to concentrate on the opportunities and then how to pay for those opportunities.
Now, I'm sure you'll hear more tonight at this community conversation that you're going to have at Lake Central High School about this, but I would imagine that you've already gotten some word, not only from parents and patrons, but from some of the business leaders there in St. John and Schererville, the areas that you serve in the Lake Central School District, about the importance of making sure that the school district is strong and is going to offer youngsters who attend classes something that they know they can use in the future.
We have had a lot of feedback from people since we finished, you know, the renovation of the high school, mm-hmm. that it has enhanced the image of our community tremendously. And, of course, we were pretty confident that would happen. Who I hear from, especially our realtors, who let us know that the supply is down in our community, which is a good sign. And it's not just the schools. I mean, it's a good place to live for a lot of different reasons, but schools are a big part of that. And we appreciate that. And so that's the kind of information we want to share with people, that we need to make sure that we are continuing to offer students, you know, an excellent opportunity to prepare themselves for life after high school.
Do you think that these opportunities that have happened in some of the other area school districts, we've mentioned already two, Hobart and Hammond, and some others that maybe didn't have quite as good luck, like East Chicago and the like, but even the publicity, the public information that has come out about these other school districts may make it easier for Lake Central Schools to be able to turn to their patrons, turn to the public, and explain why you need the assistance this time around?
I think it's important for our people to realize that for Lake Central, we have held off for quite a while. I mean, there are very few districts like us, that is, districts who are blessed to be wealthier, but through that blessing of wealth, the state gives us less per child to, you know, run our schools. But most people like us have gone back because they felt the need to do so at an earlier time. We've tried to hold off, but now it's starting to threaten those things that we really value, and that's why it's time for us to have a conversation, a serious one, make a decision, and probably in the end allow the community to decide if they think what we're suggesting is worth it, because ultimately the voters, the taxpayers, you know, will foot the bill.
Now, we know that obviously the school board is going to have to make the final decision officially anyway. They'll have to authorize talking to the Board of Elections to be able to carve out the time for a special election, or if it's going to be on the typical day, like it'd be in this case the first Tuesday in May of 2018 when it's going to be held, that you want to be sure that you have that time, or if it's a special election date that's chosen, you still have to get the school board to sign off on this officially anyway. But do you think that if the school board hears more information and more support from the public tonight at this meeting, that they're going to go ahead with the plan?
Well, you know, we've been collecting information for quite a while now, and so this meeting is, you know, an opportunity where we've use the R word. We've said, you know, we're getting serious about looking at this referendum. And so we're hoping that people come out who do have an opinion, because our board does need to factor all that stuff in before making a decision. But if we were to go in May, if we were to put it on the May election, we would have to make that decision in January. And, you know, the information we gather this evening will help us to make that decision whether we go in May or not.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you could wait, if necessary, until later in the year, maybe, where the ballot, because it's going to be crowded anyway when you look at it, because 2018 is going to be one of those election years between either the primary elections or the general election coming up in November of 2018. You may have to choose for a special election, a special date for a vote on the referendum at maybe some other time during the year?
Well, there's a cost associated with a special election, so we definitely wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But we think there's going to be a large turnout in May for the sheriff office, for one, and so we think that's a good time to go if we decide to do that. We think it's just as good of a time as November.
It's all, of course, up to the school board, and they'll want to hear from the public tonight about that. That's what the opportunity for the community conversation this evening is going to be there at Lake Central High School. Again, it's going to happen in the auditorium or theater, whichever you wish to call it, at the high school on Wicker Avenue in St. John, beginning at 6 o'clock this evening. The Lake Central School Corporation is going to bring the school board together with the public to explain more about the need for a referenda, why there's a need to ask for a request in increase of taxes in the school district, and get all the answers and all the questions answered, and get all the answers that the school board needs tonight. Larry Verocco is the superintendent of the Lake Central School Corporation. Larry, thank you very much for being with us, and hope things go well tonight at the public conversation, and we'll have some good news to report on it later.
Thanks, Chris. Hope to talk to you soon.
It's time once again for a Lakeshore Focus Conversation from Lakeshore PBS. Host Keith Kirkpatrick's guest this week is Kofi Chafu Nat Turner, who is an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts.
Every year, Purdue University Northwest brings a nationally recognized speaker to their campus for presentations on themes of race, ethnicity, diversity, and culture. It is often a reflection of history and how it has shaped our present world. For the past 4 years, we have accepted their offer to share this guest with us at Lakeshore Public Television. We have never been disappointed. In fact, we have been thrilled. This year will be no exception. Today we have with us Kofi Chafu Nat Turner, who is an associate professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Turner has an established reputation as an educator and social justice organizer working in schools in the U.S., Ghana, and Japan. I think you will find him quite interesting. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
I'm seeing that you kind of got some interesting kind of things you're wearing, so I always like guests who kind of bring something with them.
Yeah.
So what's the necklace about?
Well, the necklace, my family in Maui, Hawaii, gave me this when I landed a few weeks back, and they said, they laid me, as Hawaiians traditionally do, and so I said, I'll wear this for this outing in Indiana and share some of that good aloha spirit.
That's good. So this first name you've got, interesting name, where'd it come from?
Right. Well, Kofi is actually given to me by the nation of Ghana. I'm not Ghanaian by birth, but I went back there as a part of a study abroad program at Brown University to study kind of the roots of where African Americans come from, West Africa. And I got to study all the slave castles along the coast there. And I learned that they have seven names for the 7 days of the week, and Friday borns are called Kofi. And I was born on Friday, so they gave me that name, Kofi.
So just the day of the Friday, huh?
Yes, yes. Okay. And I've met a brother out here. His name is Kwabena. He was obviously born on Tuesday. And if you've ever met a guy named Kwesi, that would be a Sunday. And
what's the Chafu part?
Okay, and then the Chafu, my parents named me after a revolutionary in India. His name was Chafu Mazumdar. And he actually led the largest sort of communist revolution in India.
What got you into all these kind of things that you're studying and teaching and working with?
Well, again, I've been talking a lot about my grandmother and my parents. So my grandmother was a great civil rights leader, perhaps one of the greatest civil rights leaders in Los Angeles history. As I was mentioning before the show, she actually founded the Martin Luther King Hospital in South Central Los Angeles, the only public hospital in South Central Los Angeles. And she founded the Charles Drew Medical University, the only black medical university west of the Mississippi River, and one of only four medical universities in the United States, black medical universities. in the United States. Her name is Kaffee Green, a very rare name. C-A-F-F-I-E, Green with an E on the end of it.
Okay. And this was your grandmother?
My grandmother, my father's mother.
Now you mentioned you're trying to do some research on her, or you're writing a book about her?
Yes. I have a 300-page manuscript. Last year I got, UMass was so beautiful, they allowed me to go on a one-year sabbatical. So I went back to California. I lived in Oakland, and UC Berkeley gave me a title, Visiting Associate Researcher. And so I actually got...
Sounds very impressive, doesn't it?
Yeah, right? Visiting Associate Researcher. And so I got to go right back to the same office where I had written my dissertation. My PhD is from UC Berkeley. But I went into that office, and every couple weeks I'd go down to Los Angeles, and I interviewed many of the people she worked with, from dignitaries, such as ambassadors, Diane Watson, Maxine Waters, all of the different politicians she helped cultivate. I got to interview all of them, and then I would go back to my desk at Berkeley and write. So
why do you think history like that of prominent people, particularly of color, why has that been kind of held in the background or not brought to the surface?
Right.
You know, I mean, we got to see so much about Martin Luther King and some of the leaders of the civil rights movement, but there was this huge broad base of these kind of secondary leaders or second tier leaders that really were implementing so much in civil rights.
Exactly.
But we don't hear much about them.
That's correct.
Why is that?
That is a wonderful question that you're asking, and it really makes me excited about my project and why it's so necessary, okay? The first reason is they were women, okay? And as you saw the past few days, we had the largest demonstration in world history come out against the current administration. Women, for so long, have been thoroughly marginalized. It's called his story, for a reason. Men traditionally have written the story of the world. And it's now, this is a unique point in our world's time. Women's are waking up, and this full-on rights are there taking their place, not only in the United States, where women's liberation has happened, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago in some level, but this revolt or this revolution is happening in the whole world, and women are taking their place. And so this story of Kaffee Green has been pushed to the side. And, you know, the story of Los Angeles and civil rights is usually told in as far as what men did, but this is really important because not only she, but she and what is called affectionately nicknamed the Mothers of South Central Los Angeles, she worked with a cadre of black women mothers. And really, I'm telling the story of the history of LA civil rights through her.
That's fascinating. Now, your work is kind of, a lot of your work has been working with young people,
yes,
right?
That's right.
And kind of their culture. And I mean, what are you doing and how do you reach them? And what are you kind of discovering working with young people?
Wow.
That's a big question.
Yeah. And I've been teaching for the past 20 years. And I can tell you, I was at Brown, and for the summer, they made me do a little financial aid requirement. And I found a teaching position. They said if I taught that summer, it paid my whole financial aid requirement. And I was amazed. I was teaching kids from the inner city in Santa Monica. But they were in summer school not because they had done anything wrong or needed to catch up. They actually wanted to go to summer school. These were high-achieving little middle school students. And it was the perfect environment for me to just fall in love with teaching. I couldn't believe I had been a student at Brown learning about African-American history, and I got to teach them about African-American history, and I couldn't believe they were so thirsty to learn it, and I got paid to do it. I said, I don't believe this.
It's amazing how little they know sometimes. It always surprised you, like when you would say, do you know this and this? And they go, never heard that before?
Absolutely. As teachers, we live for the aha moments when students' light bulbs come on and they start to make connections between all of their lived experience and some of the, you know, new information you are bringing to the table.
You got a favorite light bulb story where you were working with a kid and the way their face lit up and what they discovered, you were like, gosh, I really made a difference in this kid's life?
Yeah, I mean,
I think... You probably got many. Does one come to mind?
I have many, but I think one I'm going to share even tomorrow at the talk. And I've shared it last night at our hip-hop sort of rap competition we had. But it's a story of a student who was in this program where I've talked about, where in the after-school program, we taught kids how to write rhymes, make beats, and also do hip-hop music videos. And this student, he said, I asked him, what did you get out of the course? As a researcher, you know, I was documenting, what were these kids getting? What were they gaining that would help them in their future? And this student said, what I learned was how I could write about my real feelings and what I felt inside. And for this student, it seemed as if he was about 12 years old. Up until that point, writing was just something you did and you gave to the teacher and got filed away. He never had envisioned writing as an opportunity to express his real feelings and as his voice. Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So you've been kind of an organizer about social justice mm-hmm. issues. I mean, that mm-hmm. that term gets thrown around a lot. You know, we should be fighting for social justice. So what does that mean to you? How do you do, when somebody says, what do you talk about when you talk about social justice?
Right. I think the one example I go to quick is when I was a young boy in high school. I went to Harvard Westlake High School, it prides itself on being the best high school, again, west of the Mississippi. It's in Beverly Hills and Bel Air. And we had what is ostensibly a great curriculum, you know, AP history, but all the history, again, was in European history. And even the U.S. history we learned, there was actually only one paragraph about slavery. And so me and some other students, we felt, we're only 17 years old. We felt, this is wrong. This is an injustice. I was learning through the hip-hop music so much of my African history, mm-hmm. through groups like X-Clan and even Ice Cube. I was learning about how great black people's history was and rich it was. But in the best high school in, the West Coast, no word of it. And so we approached the history teacher, the head of the history department, and we said, hey, we need our history represented for this to be a complete education. And we fought for it and got an ethnic studies course in high school. And really, from that point, it's just been continuing to follow in the footsteps of my grandmother, Kathy Green, and my own parents, who fought for equal rights in this country, human rights.
So sometimes when those courses are created at a college level, at a high school level, people go, why do those people have to have that focus on that piece of history or whatever? And there's a real criticism sometimes from kind of that mainline culture.
Right.
How do you respond to that when somebody says, why do you have to have your own course in black history?
Right. Well, first off, the books are inaccurate in terms of giving us a full accounting of the contributions of the diverse tapestry of American citizens which have contributed to the growth of the country. They just don't, like I mentioned, slavery, a paragraph. Slavery and things like that, have just really is what built the country. So having a full articulation of that, not only is good for all the students, right, black and brown and white, but then also it has to really, the importance really is around identity development, right? And so if we are told we've never contributed anything to society, all of our contributions are minimal, then we are likely to behave in such a way that is minimal.
Shouldn't we then have some of that in the mainline education?
Yes, absolutely.
As opposed to just saying, well, here's the people who are interested in this, let them learn.
Absolutely.
But the mainstream group is not getting that basic piece.
Absolutely. And so I'll point to two things very briefly. Is California, the state I'm very proud of, they are the first state to pass in through their house, signed by the governor, that these type of ethnic studies course that I fought for in my high school now are going to be taught mandatory in all California high schools.
Have you always been a fighter?
I like to consider myself a lover. But, but when it comes to these issues of social justice, absolutely. I have always been, willing to stand up and speak up for, what is right and what is true.
Was that incident in high school one of your first battles?
I think that, to me, that was the first one I can remember actually having to contest authority in a one-on-one manner. Yeah.
It sounds like you were successful with it.
Yes, and that success, you're right, breeds that I am able to change systems that I'm involved with.
I assume, though, as a fighter, there's been some that you didn't win.
Mm.
So, what does it mean when you can't win one, or you get push back. What does that do to you?
Right. You know what? This idea of not winning never has crossed my mind till you mentioned it right here. Because I'm from such a long history of warriors, if you will, like my grandmother and my two parents, you know, I feel like I leave it all on the battlefield each day, and I don't feel I ever lose. I'll give you one example where it may seem like I lost, and then you find out you won, right? At UC Berkeley, as a graduate student, again, I noticed the faculty. We had, you know, about 12, 13 professors. Anyway, we only had one African-American, and we had one Latina. And we, as graduate students, we wanted a course in critical race theory. This is a theory that is important in education. It just says that race is not going anywhere, but that we have to always fight it. Like I was sort of saying, we're starting to notice. It's something that's with us, and that we must keep going. So we wanted a professor who understood that to come in. So as grad students, we organized to get this professor in. Well, the many professors at UC Berkeley did not want a professor who thought like that on campus.
And I thought that was a really liberal place. So
I did too. So that's why I went there. Yeah. I was very excited. And I was shocked when these professors, after the professor, of course, we hired him totally, you know, all the credentials, totally legit. He makes it all the way to the finalist. And they figure out a way to not give him the job. But then they actually hire him through the back door as an affirmative action hire. Here's how the story ends. Not only is he a great faculty member there and very famous, but after that, UC Berkeley heard our case as graduate students and hired two more faculty of color whose research was equally progressive as him. And so, you know, I was already graduated and long gone at teaching at UMass. But then when I went back on sabbatical, all of these professors are there on the hall that I had been on.
So you obviously have this passion for social justice. Right. What do you do when you meet people, and there's lots of them, who just don't get it? And particularly people who come from a background of African American or Latino, or, you know, groups who have been marginalized.
Yeah.
And you look at them and you go, you people don't seem like you're willing to fight or stand up for what we need to do.
Right.
How do you talk to a person like that? What do you say to them?
Right. That's a great question. I think, as you can tell from my energy, it's a bit contagious, if you will. So the thing I, you know, tell them is my own stories, my own histories. And I tell them the histories that I know. And usually, it gets them fired up and ready to go, to quote one of our previous president in his campaign. Yeah.
I think that's a great question. I mean, a great answer in terms of saying it's contagious. And maybe that is the answer that you have to give. If there was a message that you wanted, that you would like to give, particularly to young people today, mm-hmm. I mean, what is that message? If I just said, there's one thing that you really wish young people would understand and absorb and with all their wholeness, what would that be?
Right. Well, again, I've been teaching 20 years and I've been working with young people 20 years, and I basically tell them the same thing that I'm going to tell you now, which is action. Take action. And for a long time, I thought about it through media, as we're doing here, filming and recording. I tell people now, with the tools of technology, they have access to basically all the information in the world through the internet. I want them to create new information, ask questions, put the pieces together in new ways, and create new information, put it online, share it with the world, and have people take that up. But then you can't leave it at that, but go into the streets and argue for what it is that you believe.
And what will that accomplish? So if they're listening to that and they go, okay, you want us to do that, we're following you, Nat, why are we doing this?
Well, in my life, in mostly every institution and place, location that I've been able to leave the place in a better situation than when I came. And that's really all we can do in our own lifetimes is, like, I talk with students about their communities, and we talked about last night, and we'll talk about tomorrow, is what are the issues in your community? What do you want to see changed? Go out and organize, 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 and do it.
Be the change, right?
Be the change.
You seem like you've been that change. Is there one, besides some of these other stories, is there one time you felt like, I really made a huge difference here?
Yeah.
I really feel I really made a difference.
Absolutely. The one that I'm still most proud of to this day, it shocks me. It still irks me a little bit that it happened when I was 19 years old. And I'm 39 now. So as a 19-year-old, still the thing I'm most proud of having ever accomplished. So as a 19-year-old, I went to do study abroad in Ghana, where they gave me this name, Kofi. And I was teaching, because I had taught a few summers before, in Los Angeles. And so I went and taught in the public schools there in Ghana. I was teaching them, interestingly enough, cultural studies. I was teaching them about their own culture, because I had studied as at the university, you know.
I've experienced that, and that's really interesting, but go ahead.
Right. So I'm teaching them about traditional West African religions and how beautiful their culture is. But anyway, so I'm in the schools, and then I'm living on a homestay with a teacher, a science teacher. And I stand outside next to a tree trying to be philosophical one day, and I ask him, I said, if you could have anything in the world, what would you want? And he said, I would like a library. And I mean, being a kid from Los Angeles, it just hit me like a ton of... I said, what? Who wants a library? That doesn't even make sense. We have libraries everywhere in Los Angeles. Why would you want to... doesn't make sense. Why would you need a library? He said, well, we don't have a library, and we pass a resolution through our village council every year for a library. And he said, they pass it, but... I said, well, why doesn't it happen? He said, well, it doesn't happen because we don't have the money for the books, they say. I said, okay. We have so many books in the United States. I promise I'll send the books. That's all I can promise. I will send the books. But then I went back to Brown. I wrote a little grant for $4,000, actually. Went back and built the library. The village donated a temporary site, an old bank. We scrubbed it with our hands, washed it clean. And the village donated lights and tables. And I sent the books. And that library, founded in 97, went back in 98 and built it. And then in 2000, I walked in. No one recognized me. I walked in, pulled a book off the shelf, sat down, looked up, and I saw all these children reading around me. And
Lakeshore Focus airs on Fridays at 7:30 p.m. on Lakeshore PBS. Indiana teens experience a number of growing social and emotional needs, but support can be hard to come by in the one place they may turn to, schools. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us about one system that hopes to develop a comprehensive counseling program that can be in turn repeated across Indiana.
Teens at Fishers High School in a wealthy northern suburb of Indianapolis may seem to have it made, but many confront issues that could lead to larger problems. Support for young Hoosiers having social and emotional issues is limited, but this year, things got a little easier for these students.
We were able to start this school year out with a mental health therapist in all of our buildings.
Brooke Lawson is the mental health coordinator for the Hamilton Southeastern School District.
Our counselors are generalists, and they aren't able to provide mental health counseling to students.
But when they are able to make the right connections, say, to a therapist in the building, it can mean the issue, which may otherwise escalate, gets addressed. Lawson says schools provide access may be the one place where students can find an open door. Hamilton Southeastern hired her after a city referendum to provide mental health services at its 21 schools. Her position is not usually on district payrolls in Indiana.
I hear all around the state how, you know, parents and students and teachers and staff aren't open to this whole thought of mental health providers in the schools or even students receiving mental health services in the schools. And I think that we're lucky as a community because our mayor started the conversation.
Fishers Mayor Scott Fadness kicked off a citywide mental health initiative 3 years ago. He was struck by how many people in his community had mental health problems and the city's high suicide rates, 11 to 14 people a year. A coalition of city stakeholders have committed to the issue, including schools. It was through a planning grant from the Lilly Endowment the district conducted a survey. The Hamilton Southeastern Schools Foundation's Freedom Kolb helped the system administer the grants.
Our community is underserved by public mental health supports. Our students are at a heightened risk for anxiety and some other threats to mental health. But what it confirmed to us was that our counselors were really stretched very thin, doing an assortment of work.
But that frontline support system isn't always available. Indiana has one of the lowest rates of counselors per students in the nation, says Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman.
When you think about that, one individual counselor trying to work with a caseload of 500 students, it's overwhelming.
The IYI helps to coordinate the Lilly Endowment grants that went out to 57 Indiana schools this year. The foundation has committed nearly $30 million over 5 years to close the gap. Silverman says in her discussions, one issue stands out.
I will tell you, overwhelmingly, the school said they need help in the area of social and emotional needs of their students, that those needs have just grown so complex over the past few years, and that they all acknowledge that the well-being of their students are foundational to every other bit of work.
Kids Count data finds close to 30% of Hoosier High School students report feeling sad or hopeless for 2 weeks or more. Students meet a range of issues, such as anxiety to succeed, social media pressures, bullying, or substance use disorders. Silverman says the Lilly counseling grants have already made an impact.
The change has already happened in that many of the schools hadn't had robust conversations about what does comprehensive counseling look like.
Even more impactful may be the conversations started between young Hoosiers. Both Fishers High Schools have stigma-free clubs, says Brooke Lawson.
Those students have the goal of creating a community in their school that is open to talking about mental illness and mental health.
This year, Hamilton Southeastern Schools received the Lilly Endowment's largest gift due to their size. They plan to use the money to implement a comprehensive counseling model. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And from the Post Tribune, we'll have Meredith Colias-Pete with us, along with Carrie Napoleon. And from the Times, Bill Dolan will be with us to talk about their stories. We hope you'll join us tomorrow.